and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Valdana Hayrick, a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg.
And I'm Katie Greifeld, filling in for Mike Regan. I am also a cross-asset reporter at Bloomberg. I'm also the co-anchor of Quick Take Stock. It is a daily market show for Bloomberg Quick Take.
And this week on the show, Thanksgiving is around the corner and Wall Street is looking back on a stellar year, while also trying to predict what 2022 might bring. Everyone's still contending with lots of things, including hotter than expected inflation, bubble talk, and projections that the 60-40 portfolio is dead. We're going to get into all of that with our guest, the head of global multi-assets at a major investment firm. But first, Katie, I wanted to welcome you to the show. Mike's out this week, and that's actually really perfect because you and I have a lot to talk about. We've been hanging out recently, most notably at some football games. And then just a reminder for me and you, Mike said that we must make a joke on this week's podcast.
Listen, I don't have jokes. I have nothing but facts. I've learned a lot about football in particular in the last week. I've heard a lot about Josh Allen. Apparently he's really good. I've learned that in trouble, you throw to Diggs, he'll get it done. On the Jets though, Mike White, I mean, next Tom Brady, I don't know.
I don't think so. For all of our listeners, Katie and I went to the Bills and Jets game this past weekend and we had the best time. And Katie heard a lot of really amazing catchphrases that she was using throughout the game. And I think it worked out.
Really, I think so. I mean, I was soliciting cool catchphrases I could sprinkle into conversation. The Bills, they had a pretty rough game the weekend before, so they really needed to come out with their hair on fire.
With their hair on fire. That's right.
They delivered. The Jets did get two touchdowns in. This is now a sports podcast, by the way.
This is. Everybody who's tuning in for commentary on the stock market, you can delete now. Well, we can ask our guest this week about football as well, possibly. But let's bring in Sebastian Page, who's the head of global multi-asset at T. Rowe Price. And he's also the author of a new book called Beyond Diversification, which we'll also discuss on the podcast today. Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vildana and Katie. Thank you for having me. Really happy to participate today.
Are you a football fan?
Yeah, I'm in Baltimore, Maryland, so it's the Ravens for me.
Oh, go Bills all the way.
I don't have any fun facts about the Ravens, unfortunately.
You'll have to let her know ahead of time next time. But Sebastian, I was hoping you could help set things up for us and just give us a little bit more about your role at T. Rowe and what your strategy looks like right now.
Yeah, thank you. You know, my role at T. Rowe, I like to say, is the perfect job for me. I absolutely love it. I'm running a large global investment organization. In this case, over $450 billion in AUM, and we oversee over 220 portfolios. And by the way, we have the number one actively managed retirement product in terms of assets under management and performance. The job, Vildana, involves not only investment oversight, so, you know, staying on top of capital markets, consuming vast amounts of research, all from Bloomberg, of course, and so on, but I also run the business, which means setting a strategic vision, making sure it's executed well, importantly, recruiting and developing talent, managing large product development projects. I'm also a member of the firm's management committee, which means I'm representing the division at the firm-wide level, and I help manage the firm. And by the way, at T. Rowe Price, we have $1.6 trillion in assets under management, over 7,800 employees in 16 countries. You know, we have a good brand, but we also have this ethos of keeping our heads down and focusing on investment performance. So for some people, and maybe some people in our audience today, sometimes we're like the biggest asset manager they've never heard of. Bottom line is the job is broad. I learn something every day. There are investment challenges and leadership challenges. So if you follow me on LinkedIn, by the way, I realize I'm starting to sound like an influencer. I only have LinkedIn. I don't have Twitter or anything else. But you'll see that I started posting on capital markets, of course, but I started posting short articles on psychology and leadership as well, because that's a part of my job. So Sorry for the LinkedIn plug. I'm just starting to get a few followers and we're trying to ramp up our digital brand as a firm. But yeah, the bottom line is it's a broad job. It's a leadership and an investment job.
Sebastian, we got to get you on Twitter. It's where all the action is. You would fit right in at FinTwit. But we are in the special time of year where we have about 6 weeks to go until 2022. And as such, we're starting to see a lot of year ahead outlooks trickle out. And I'm curious to hear your view on what we're heading into next year, because I mean, just we're still waiting on tenterhooks to see who Biden's Fed nominee will be, for example. We know that inflation is at levels we haven't seen in decades. Curious how you're taking all these different inputs and seeing how the year ahead might look.
Katie, a simple question right now that's on everyone's mind is, are stocks in a bubble? And it's really a complicated question. They're both, and this is going to sound unusual, but I can make the statement that at the same time that stocks are both as expensive as they've ever been and as cheap as they've ever been. So how do I get to that statement? If I look at the price earnings ratio on the stock market on the S&P 500, it's in the 99th percentile compared to the last 30 years. Maybe it got more expensive around the tech bubble, but pretty much close to as expensive as they've ever been. But if you think stocks are expensive, have you looked at bonds recently? And if you compare the valuation of stocks, that PE ratio, and you can invert it and look at the yield, which makes an easier comparison, with bond yields, and in particular, real rates, the yield you get on bonds after inflation, then you get to the conclusion that it's in the bottom 1%. So stocks are as cheap as they've ever been. So it's a confusing time for asset allocators. We just had a debate between the bulls and the bears in our asset allocation committee. So as we look into 2022, the bears are arguing that we've borrowed from the recovery. In other words, valuations are a sign of that. And monetary and fiscal policy have been so extreme that one of our committee members said, look, every inch of recovery will get taken away by the Fed's need to taper. And on the fiscal side, we're kind of at the end of the days of sending checks to people. One reason to worry about asset valuations is that it's been liquidity driven. I listen to your podcast. I'm a fan, by the way. I listen to it every weekend. I listen to your weirdest things in markets. So you see the speculation there when you hear your comments about the weirdest things in market, right? You mentioned at one time that someone bought the JPEG, an NFT, the JPEG of a rock, a dancing rock or a rock with red eyes for 1.1 million, right? The other one I think you mentioned was the Shiba Inu coin, which is a spoof coin on a spoof coin on Dogecoin, right? Someone had $8,000 in an account and then a year and a half later, that account was worth $5.7 billion. So when I talk about liquidity and speculation in markets, you have these micro bubbles, and this is an illustration of what makes the bears nervous. So thank you for these examples. I'm using them in some of my presentations now. So what are the bulls saying in our committee now? They're saying that, look, peak growth doesn't mean low growth. The Delta situation, ultimately, we hope, will be better in 6, 9, 12 months. Think about a back-to-normal world where there's less COVID, supply chains maybe slowly but still normalize, services spending increases, and so on. So the bulls are saying growth is slowed and delayed, but it's not derailed. We're still in a recovery. The number that sticks in my mind, and you hear it a lot in the financial media, is this $2 trillion sitting in people's checking accounts, right? This concept of pent-up demand. And companies are flush with cash, too. And there's a massive wealth effect at some point from asset price appreciation. And here's something that's not talked about much, pent-up housing. single-family housing units under construction at its highest level in 15 years. And this is due to supply shortages, we know. Also, the percentage of houses for sale but not started is at its highest level in history, almost double the long-term average. So just that pent-up housing, our economists here thinks that it can add 75 basis points to GDP growth next year as some of these things start to normalize. So the bottom line is that over the next year, we will face declining growth, but still very high growth. Declining liquidity, but still very high liquidity. And settle into the mid-cycle game. For that game, you need earnings to sustain stocks more than rising valuations, which is what happened this year. Price earnings ratios actually went down on the margin, but earnings have been so strong that stocks have continued to make new highs. You know, it's a massively distorted economy. Ultimately, we're more bearish on bonds than stocks. So where do we settle all of this between the bears and the bulls is that we have taken some profits in our portfolios by selling some stocks. But on the margin, we've sold about 1% of our stocks exposure. But we're also long growth. We're also long the economy. So we've added risk back into the portfolio through relative valuation. So to go long the economy, long cyclicality, we have shorted treasuries, we have added on the margin to credit, and we're long small cap and value stocks. So we're adding back cyclicality into the portfolio as we're selling some stocks on the margin. That's how we settle the debate. That's how we're thinking about 2022.
So Sebastian, you actually stole my next question because I wanted to ask you about, I saw in one of your recent notes that you guys did recently sell 1% of your equity exposure. So I wanted to ask you about that. And I wanted to ask you to look ahead to next year because my colleagues and I were thinking about what some of the strategists have been coming out with, as Katie mentioned, for their year ahead outlooks. And I wanted to ask you how true it is that a lot will depend on where rates and yields are. And then another one of your comments recently had said that you guys moved some assets into liquid alternatives. And I wanted to ask you what specifically that is.
Yeah, let me start with the liquid alternatives question. So as you sell some stocks, maybe you start taking a bit of profit, you pull back a little bit, you stay diversified, you stay invested. But the question becomes, where do you put the money? And this relates to the 60-40 question as well. About 12% of our core bonds exposure has been transferred in our flagship global allocation strategy to liquid alternatives. Those are strategies that are active management focused. So you need skilled active management to succeed here. And they allow for short positions. They're not linked to the big market trends in either equity returns or interest rates. So that's how we add some diversification into the portfolio. We've also added on the margin to loans as an asset class. Bank loans tend to do okay when rates rise relative to long treasuries, for example. And we've also added, but not too much, but on the margin to credit more broadly, high yield in particular. So that's how we're positioned from a tactical perspective at the moment.
So Sebastian, it's been about 14 minutes that I've been recording. Haven't brought up crypto yet, but I'm going to do that right now because when you think about a diversified portfolio, obviously the Bitcoin as an inflation hedge narrative has reared up again, especially after that really, really hot CPI figure that we got for October. How do you think about crypto as an asset class?
First of all, just look at the size of crypto, and it's hard to disagree with the idea that it is an asset class. Overall, it's bigger than, say, the high-yield bond market in the U.S. So it is a force to be reckoned with. In most of our portfolios in our business, our clients aren't giving us the mandate to invest in crypto, but we do research in that space because it's going to influence how a lot of companies do business in multiple sectors. We have an army of stock analysts at T. Rowe Price, and so some of them are following the space. We're looking at it at this point, personally, I can say, not from an inflation hedge perspective, simply because it's just still such a speculative asset class, and it's really driven by technicals, sentiment. Sometimes crypto moves, and that's why I don't envy being in your business, Katie and Vildana, because it's just hard to actually explain, right? Oh, it's down 10%. Oh, maybe it's this tweet and it's a bit mysterious, nebulous. This is a sign that it's still an asset class that moves on sentiment and speculation. I'm just going to throw a number. I haven't done the math, but let's suppose 80% of the volatility of crypto really is speculation, trend chasing, sentiment. Well, that doesn't make for a really good inflation hedge, unless maybe you think about it from a very, very long-term perspective. It's an evolving space. It's an important space for asset allocators to think about. The fact that it's highly volatile is not necessarily an issue. It means that it's more capital efficient, all else being equal. But it's still, for us, not an inflation hedge, as we would think of a traditional inflation hedge. Sorry, I'm sounding a bit old school here, but...
No, this is great, and I'm really glad that we brought up inflation, because Katie wrote the cover of Business Week this week, and it's all about the idea that technically,
and Vildana was in on it too. So
I was part of it, but her story, it was so good. If you haven't seen it, you have to go see it. It's all about how important it is to get the inflation call right for portfolio manager heading into 2022. And so I wanted to ask you where you fall on the transitory or not debate, and then what some potential inflation hedges are, because that was what was part of my article for Business Week. It was about, you know, do you buy Bitcoin or gold or REITs or whatever else? So what might you recommend as an inflation hedge?
Yeah, really good question, Vildana. In fact, it's kind of become the question right now. COVID is an absolute disaster, but it's almost taken a back seat to the inflation question. First of all, I'll say, well, we've solved the riddle of how to create inflation in the developed world. It's fiscal policy, not monetary, right? We've dropped, I don't know, 400 million checks of over $1,000 right from the helicopters. So there's too much money demand chasing too little stuff to buy, especially goods, which creates supply issues. This is not new. Everybody's talking about the mother of all traffic jams. At this point, you know, at T. Rowe, we don't have a house view. So portfolio managers across our investment platform are actually divided on the question as to whether we'll face runaway inflation, which, Vildana, the trick with the transitory question is that everyone has a different definition of transitory. So you sort of need to define transitory first and then express your view. So here I'm going to say, maybe rephrase the question, are we going to face runaway out of control inflation that will force the Fed's hand? You know, from a long-term perspective, technology, globalization have put downward pressures on prices. And if you go back to, say, 2000, and you look at the trends in different components of inflation, look at, say, flat screen TVs, computers, all that stuff has gotten really cheaper and cheaper since 2000 and before. And so you have China-made stuff you can buy on Amazon, really cheap stuff, apparel, furniture, toys. You know, maybe we'll buy less stuff from China, but globalization is sort of unstoppable, right? So made in Vietnam, Malaysia, India. So those long-term trends, technology, globalization, persist in the background. We don't really think about them right now because we have supply issues and other more pressing concerns to address. So from a shorter-term perspective, there are reopening effects. We just had to print at 6.2% headline. You see a big component of it was used cars, up about 30. But also inflation is becoming more broad-based. You see rents lag real estate. Real estate is up by about 20%. Expect rents to go up based on the historical relationship. When people get to renew their lease, they will most likely see a price increase. And then there's energy, which is also a puzzle. So gasoline is up 50% over the last 12 months. So if you're looking at projecting inflation into next year, it could say, look, it's unlikely that gasoline will be up another 50%, and used cars probably won't be up another 25-30%. But if you look at shelter, a third of the CPI, you know, it was up only 3.5% over the period for that last print of 6.2%. So it kind of doesn't add up with real estate being up 20%. That is more structural. And of course, wage inflation is more structural. So I think overall, I think we're close to peak inflation, but we won't settle back down to pre-COVID sub 2% numbers in the foreseeable future. Right now, as we speak, five-year break-even inflation is trending up. It's at 3.2%. And that seems reasonable to me, but it's a problem because the Fed is, you know, you can be flexible. The Fed can be flexible targeting 2%, but there's flexible. And then there's, as break-evens are implying, letting inflation average above 3% over the next 5 years. Something has to give. Just to quickly hit Vildana on how do you hedge those risks? We hold short-term tips in the portfolio. Interestingly, those are up about 7% this year compared to minus 1.3% for the Barclays Ag. But overall, expected returns on short-term tips are fairly low where we sit now. We also hold, as people talk about gold, crypto we've just talked about, we also hold a fund of real asset equities. So these are stocks. Katie and Vildana. These are stocks, but these are stocks that are inflation sensitive. So think about real estate REITs, metals and mining companies, precious metals, energy companies. So what you get with this real asset equity strategies is a levered response to inflation, right? So if you get an inflation shock, it'll go up by 5-6x. And you also get stock exposure in the long run that tends to pay off. And so that's strategies up significantly over the last year as it's done its job of hedging the surprises in inflation. Now, everyone's worried about what the Fed will do. We're all scared of rising rates. I'm going to end my answer to this really important question on inflation with a riddle for you. Katie, Vildana, what do egg yolks, red wine, coffee, and rising rates have in common?
You can have them all for breakfast.
Well, yeah, we could quibble on wine, but on occasion.
Not on this podcast.
So the idea is that you don't really, if you look at research and you're into health and fitness, you don't really know if these things are good or bad for you. Right? It kind of can go both ways. That's the same thing for rising rates. We actually did a study and we looked at 9 times that the Fed pivoted towards higher rates since 1979. And that included the 2013 taper. And we looked at stock returns 12 months before the pivot and 12 months after the pivot, which gave us 18 observations. 17 of those saw positive stock returns. And the stock returns were 15% on average. So everyone's, you know, everyone's freaking out about rising rates, but the Fed is only comfortable hiking and pivoting in a strong economic environment. The Fed doesn't raise rates in a recession. So the initial pivot is usually not as damaging as you might think to risk assets. This is historical evidence. Things could play out differently based on what we just talked about around inflation. But it just gives you some perspective about rising rates and
like
coffee
that,
and egg yolks.
I like that all three of us agree we can have rates for breakfast.
Absolutely. Delicious. with, you know, a little bit of cinnamon. But I did want to ask, you know, you mentioned that everyone is worried about rising rates. Feels like, you know, on and off, everyone is also worried about rising long-term bond yields. But if you look at the bond market, I feel like that has almost become a pain trade, because I'm looking at 30-year treasury yields right now, especially for the past 6 months or so. It feels like they just can't hold above 2%. Same with 10-year yields. I mean, 1.75 got there for a second and then we went right back down. What's going on in that market? Because, I mean, inflation is here and it's hot, but yet long-term treasury yields still quite low.
It's remarkable, isn't it? What an important question. 10-year yield at 1.6, inflation running at 6%, growth running at 5, 6%. So you're talking about nominal growth above 10% with the 10-year yield at 1.6%. It's a really big, unusual spread. And then when you subtract the inflation from the 10-year yield, you get an all-time low number, like less than minus 1%. So what's going on? Many things influence the direction of rates. Probably the most important is an extremely dovish Fed, even in the face of everything that's happening with inflation and the recovery. The other thing is that there is a lot of demand from outside the United States for treasuries. And if you're an investor based in Japan, for most of the last 12 months, treasuries were hovering towards, on a hedged basis, back to your home country, kind of like close to a 10-year high. So you actually, rates are so low in some countries that this creates demand, even for the long end, for treasuries, it keeps rates low. When all is said and done right now, our largest tactical position in our portfolios is to underweight treasuries. And Katie, to your question, underweight the long end. It's starting to look like a coiled spring, this valuation. And if you look forward over the next 12 months, it's possible that the direction of rates is higher. If break-even inflation, as I mentioned earlier, over 5 years is 3.2, the Fed has to do something, even under flexible average inflation targeting, to stay around 2%. So it's there's a little bit of an asymmetry, right? How much lower can they go from here and how much higher can they go from here? I'd rather be on the side of higher.
So Sebastian, I wanted to ask you one more question before we get into the weirdest thing, and it's about your book called Beyond Diversification. And I'm hoping you can set up for us how you're thinking about diversification, considering all of the things that we were just talking about. And granted, those are, you know, some more short-term things, but how should people be thinking about diversification? Why did you feel it's important to write this book?
Yeah, thank you for the question. Think about the, is the 60-40 portfolio dead question. In a sense, that's a question the book addresses. I cover asset allocation for the long run, how you do tactical asset allocation, and how you think about risk. And I revisit how we think about the concept of diversification. So around COVID, the book was still in production. And the media all of a sudden latched on this question, is the 60-40 dead? I called McGraw-Hill and tried to change the title to Is the 60-40 Dead? But unfortunately, it was too late. So it would have been a better title than Beyond Diversification. But Vildana, it gives you an idea what the book is about. How do you construct a portfolio given current conditions? I review about 200 academic articles, but I make it really, really user-friendly. There's no math, no equations. I also refer to our own experience managing portfolios. And in the third section, you get model portfolios too, to give you an idea of, depending on what you're trying to do, what the asset allocation would look like.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
We talked about a lot of weird things on the podcast so far, but we have to get to our weirdest things that we all saw this week. I know Mike usually does this section and sets us up and plays little games, and I'm not as fancy as Mike is, so I think we'll just have to go around and go over the weirdest things that we saw, each of us. Sebastian, if you'd like to start.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to start. I've asked my entire strategy team for ideas for this segment, and here's the problem. So Donna, Katie, I got too many, and I didn't know which one to choose. So people talked about the size of Avis in the index, the squid coin, which went up millions of percent, then crashed to zero, how big the FANGMAs have gotten. I heard Rob Arna on your podcast talk about that. Amazon collecting 35 cents of every dollar spent online, and so on. So it's just like, which one am I going to choose? I know you always talk about crypto, not always, but often talk about crypto, some items that are selling at auction, right? I hear Mike sometimes trying to make people guess how much the items are selling for. So those ideas were off the table. I settled on one that I read this week, but I cheated. And I know Mike, he's not on the show right now, so maybe we can say he cheats sometimes.
He for sure cheats. He cheats all the time. So you can cheat this week too.
Thank you. So it's something I read this week, but it actually occurred in the 80s. And it's more broadly related to marketing than markets per se. And I guess I can make it a game, a quiz. So McDonald's, this is going to be a quiz. Back in the 80s, McDonald's had so much success with their quarter pounder that apparently A&W decided to offer a bigger, juicier third pound burger at the same price. The product was a huge flop. It was a bigger third pounder, juicier. It was to compete with the quarter pounder. It was the same price, but it was a huge flop. So my quiz for you is, guess why?
I know this one. I have the answer. Vildana, do you have the answer?
I don't have the answer.
Okay, here's the answer. It's because 4 is bigger than 3. So people heard quarter pounder and said, oh, that has a 4 in it. That's bigger than 3. That's right, wow. Right?
That is the reason it went down in history as a huge marketing fail, because after the fact, A&W realized that a lot of people, too many, thought that a quarter pounder was bigger than a third pounder.
Wow.
I'm pitiful at math, but I at least know that.
This is amazing. I think you win. I mean, Katie and I don't even have to go. You win. Katie will get to go. But Sebastian, you have so many good ones. This is why you need a Twitter, so you can tweet about these weird things.
I don't have a thick enough skin to get on Twitter.
It's a rough, it's brutal out there.
It can be toxic, but you find your nice little niches, and people are generally nice.
Katie and I will follow you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Katie, what's your weirdest thing?
My turn? Yeah. Okay. It's not so much like a crazy thing that I saw, but it is a fun fact. So Sweetgreen salad chain, it went public this past week, valuation of almost $3 billion. And Bloomberg had a great story. Drew Singer wrote it. So there's been 11 food and beverage IPOs this year. That is the most since 1997. Did not know that. There's only one, I mean, pretending that Sweetgreen hasn't happened, there's only one 2021 food or beverage IPO that's trading higher this year. It's a winemaker called Duckhorn Portfolio, and the ticker is Napa, which is adorable.
Wow. What a great ticker.
I think it's up 30% this year, so outperforming the S&P 500 at this point.
Well, I will say, I think the last time I went to Sweetgreen's, I spent like $17 for one salad, so...
Inflation everywhere.
They better be making money with those types of prices.
You'd have to imagine so, or they're doing something wrong.
Yeah, well, Donna, sure.
It's your turn, though.
Oh, yes, it's my turn. That's right. So this one is courtesy of Stacey Marie Ishmael, who's the head of crypto for us over here at Bloomberg. And she shared this story from earlier in the week. It's titled, Barbados is to become the first sovereign nation with an embassy in the metaverse.
Oh, my God.
Oh.
Wow. I mean, just wow. The article says Barbados is preparing to legally declare digital real estate sovereign land with the establishment of a metaverse embassy. And I just had this great, you know, picture in my head of people going into, you know, in this digital metaverse, lining up at the embassy for their passport, whatever needs. I don't even know. So that's
sort of some point. Do you need a passport in the metaverse? Are there countries and borders in the metaverse? Do I have to pay rent in the metaverse? Thinking about the metaverse makes me spiral.
I think you and I should just start a business now about, you know, getting everybody settled in the metaverse.
Yeah. Move-in service.
Yeah. I don't know, Sebastian, what you think about the metaverse. Katie and I have many thoughts.
Yeah, it's puzzling. I think about my kids who just through COVID have just spent so much time on Minecraft and, you know, those types of games. And I think about 10 years from now, what really all of this will look like. And I don't know. It's puzzling exactly where this is going, and the fact that Facebook is leading the charge is also puzzling. So we'll see how it plays out. I don't know. I'm not ready to. If I'm going to visit Barbados, I think I'm going to go in person.
And I mean, you're not even on Twitter. How are you going to get into the metaverse?
Right. Exactly. I'm way behind here.
Way behind. I think we'll have to leave it at that. Thank you both so much for joining us. Sebastian, thank you for joining the podcast. We're looking forward to having you back on. And Katie, I think we just don't call Mike Regan back ever again for the podcast. I think you're welcome to be the new... Who is he?
I don't know that man.
Me neither. I've already forgotten about him. So thank you both so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me, at Vildana Heirich. Katie Greifeld is at K Greifeld. And our guest, Sebastian Page, is on LinkedIn. You can find him at Sebastian-Page. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellet of Bloomberg Radio. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening and see you next time.